Chapter 6. The corporate offices of Anagnorisis Technologies were located in the Manhattan Business District. Human resources, finance, legal, and much of the executive management staff under the strategic planning arm of the company. The R&D lab was housed at a remote, nondescript office about an hour and a half north of the New York City boundary, west of the Hudson River, accessed by meandering two-lane highways that delved first through picturesque suburban neighborhoods before becoming lost in the tree-choked countryside. Giles looked from the rear seat of the sedan, held enraptured by the scrolling fields of green, yellow, and orange, the spindled white and brown trunks of trees he could not begin to name, the rocky paths and rushing streams. Following his first 2 days buried in the heart of the city, he felt he may have stumbled into a new world entire. He first tried, having penetrated deep into the country, to look ahead of the driver to see where they went, but soon gave up. The road was ever winding, and he could see ahead perhaps only 500 yards at best. He contented himself with watching the blurred surrounding world and submitted to the hypnosis of the unfamiliar. They arrived at an unmarked building shortly after 8, a squat gray box jarring in its divergence from the architecture to which he had fast adjusted on the previous day. It was depressingly square, with flat walls, large tinted windows at regular intervals, a loading dock around the side, and a fat blue stripe running around the top edge as a minimal concession to color. The sole characteristic that saved it from appearing to be a cog manufacturing warehouse was to Giles's eyes the fact that it had only one story. The structures to which he had grown accustomed always towered stupidly in the middle of a sprawling lot. The saving grace of this new place was that the parking lot was minuscule compared to the implied square footage of the building itself, and the trees encroached close to the walls, obscuring much of its ugliness, distracting even from the fact that the tops of the HVAC units were visible over the wall. The driver pulled up to a short unloading area outside the lobby, parked and circled around the back to hold the door for Giles. He declined his tip when offered, bowed, and soon disappeared into the far-off trees, leaving Giles alone in the close, unnatural stillness of the natural surroundings. He stood uncomfortably for a few moments, searching with all senses for something familiar, and when he heard one of the HVAC units switch on overhead, felt better. The sucking sound of an open door issued from behind him, and a voice said, "Sir?" He allowed himself to be ushered into the building, heart rate coming slowly under control as his eyes adjusted to the ache of the overhead lighting. The man who held the door for him retreated behind the reception desk. He was a powerfully built black man, the lines of his hair and spine both straight as a razor, and moved as though he patrolled his domain. Giles moved to join him at the desk, set his bag down on the floor, and retrieved his wallet. "Giles Guittery, here to see Marcus Gennaro, please," he said softly, seeking to minimize the violation his voice must do to the pristine silence of the audience chamber. He passed his driver license over the countertop. "Very well, sir," the receptionist boomed, voice echoing through the room. He picked up an old-fashioned telephone and spoke into the handset, though Giles missed what he said, finding his attention distracted by a coffee cup on the desk emblazoned with the text U.S. Army. "Mr. Gennaro will be out shortly, sir." He had the voice of a singer, fit to command an auditorium. "I'll just have a seat," Giles said and collected his bag.
"Very good, sir."
He heard the sound of typing, heavy fingers impacting the keyboard like little bombs. Giles sat rigidly in a chair across from a large framed picture of a huge white rocket, bulbous tip jutting proudly over an explosion of smoke and chemical hellfire. The title at the bottom of the picture said Falcon X. He thought about this for a moment and wondered if Anagnorisis had anything to do with that program. He could not remember encountering any such intelligence during his mad research spree on the flight over.
"Do you desire the Wi-Fi, sir?"
No, thank you, I'm fine." The man nodded in such a way that Giles felt as if he passed a test. A few minutes later, the receptionist lifted the phone to his ear and said,
"Yes, sir."
Then he hung it up and said,
"You'll be required to leave your phone and laptop up front, sir."
"Oh," Giles said, glancing down at his bag.
I'm technically not to let this laptop out of my sight."
"I see.
Are you permitted to lock it in a safe, as in when you're in a hotel and wish to leave for dinner?
Oh, yes, of course.
The man nodded.
That's fine then, sir. Please come around the desk.
Giles was led to a hallway just out of sight of the main entrance. They came to a heavy-looking door, and the man waved a badge in front of the handle before stepping through to hold it open. On the other side, there was a small room with a line of push-button box safes along one wall.
Pick a unit not currently occupied, sir, and place any and all electronic devices within. Set a combination you can remember, please. I cannot open the safe for you without a high-priority override. Please, do not make us go through the paperwork for that.
He was left alone in the small space. Giles emerged into the reception area a few moments later, feeling oddly naked without his briefcase. Marcus was there waiting for him on the other side of the counter, hands thrust distractedly into pockets. His expression suggested he was not entirely sure if anything he now did had a point.
"Good morning, Mr. Gennaro," Giles said, holding out a hand.
Marcus snorted lightly, offered a token shake, and grunted.
"Morning. You all signed in? Got your crap unloaded?"
Yes. I was wondering if I could beg the use of a notebook, though. I'll need to take some notes while I'm here, I should think.
"Beg the use?" Marcus asked slowly.
"Yes, to take notes."
Marcus smiled through tightened lips and said,
"Yeah, no worries. You'll find everything you need within. You'll have to leave it behind when you leave, though."
"I can't take my notes home with me in the evening?"
"Yeah, no. That's bad mojo, Doc. Did you not read that part in your NDA?"
"I missed it, apparently," Giles muttered.
"Huh. No big deal. We'll keep an eye on you to make sure you don't incriminate yourself. Come on, let's head back."
Marcus stopped and looked back at him.
Can I call my wife? She only has my cell number to get a hold of me. I'd like to leave a number for her to call if she needs me."
Marcus smiled again. The corners of his mouth pulled down instead of up, and Giles wondered if that was his natural expression or if Gennaro reserved it only for those occasions where he wished his guests to feel uneasy. Still smiling, he glanced at the man behind the desk and said,
"Sam?"
The old-fashioned black phone was placed on the high counter at Giles's elbow.
"The number's on the handset, sir," Sam said.
Marcus strolled to the inner door to wait while Giles punched in his wife's number. It went to voicemail, so he whispered,
"Hey, babe, just calling to let you know that you can't get me on my cell while I'm out here. Their security is, pretty next level, ha-ha. So, if you need to get a hold of me, you'll want to dial, 845-258-2500. That'll be the front desk, then you just ask for me. We'll see you later. Love you. Bye."
He passed the phone back to Sam, nodded, and met Marcus at the door.
"All set?"
"Yes, thank you," Giles nodded.
"Yahtzee," he said,
and badged into a cubicle farm of middling size, divided by a wide center aisle leading straight through to a set of double doors at the far end. Giles paused for a moment to take in the scenery before he realized that Marcus was already halfway across the floor and showing no signs of waiting up. He trotted across the gray carpeted floor, catching up to the other man just as he opened the double doors.
"I thought you might be giving me a desk in here or something," Giles said lamely.
"No,"
Marcus said quietly. When the doors shut, he cleared his throat and said,
"You don't want to be in there. That's where the goons go. Your spot's in the lab where the action is."
He turned and proceeded down the hall, muttering under his breath as he went. It sounded to Giles as though he said something along the lines of, "where we can keep an eye on you." But he could not be sure. There was a long corridor on the other side of the double doors, stretching toward a distant vanishing point before making an abrupt right turn. The yellow-green linoleum tiles were heavily polished, and the gleam from the overhead lights reflected in their surface, seeming to float along with him as he walked, like wisps. The corridor itself was wide enough for six to walk abreast, and walled on either side at regular intervals with large glass cabinets showcasing past successes. Many of these were awards granted by some governing body or other, and some housed engineering curiosities of varying complexity.
Giles opened his mouth to inquire after one of these, but was soon distracted by a long, gorgeously lit case running the remaining length of the left wall. Housed within were a series of automata, starting at a squat, six-wheeled probe reminiscent of a planetary rover, then progressing through a series of technological iterations depending from that antecedent. Six wheels graduating to treads, treads replaced with a quadrupedal base, quadrupedal base devolving to two treads and a tertiary caster with upright chassis and top-mounted camera. Finally, at the end of the line, a mechanical humanoid androgyne, indistinguishable in feature, with great, blunt weights for hands at the end of stunted arms and long, sweeping piston legs.
Giles, you okay?
He had stopped to stare.
Yes. I just remember seeing this a few years back. It was all over the news when it beat Kinsley in the 400.
Marcus laughed.
Sure, that was fun.
Yeah, fun's one way to describe it, Giles muttered. He leaned in closer to the glass.
Is this the actual...
The unit that ran the race? That's it.
Giles shook his head. He leaned away from the glass to wipe at the patch of fog he had exhaled onto the surface. Buffing the spot with his shirt cuff, he whispered,
So, beat an Olympian and they lock you under glass.
He pulled his hand away from the casing and looked for any signs of streaking. The surface seemed as clear as it was likely to get with the tools available to him, clear enough for him to read the model designation along the chest plate. Hermes.
I'll confess a soft spot for Greek mythology, Marcus said. Should we continue on now?
Sorry, Giles said, and followed him around the bend. As they walked, Marcus slowed to fall in beside him. He seemed on the verge of speaking, yet hesitated. Curious, Giles opened his mouth to ask what it was about, but Marcus blurted,
I'm abrupt sometimes, Giles. I think we covered that yesterday.
Yes.
A part of that comes, I think, from an inherent distaste for wasting time.
I see. You believe your time is being wasted now?
Yours too,
Marcus said, gesturing vaguely in his direction.
Look, Kevin has a lot of pie-in-the-sky ideas, you see. He's a doctorate in theoretical physics. They get like that, no offense. I think a guy like that ends up spending too much time in the theoretical realm. Well, he gets disconnected, if you take my meaning. Theory's all well and good, I suppose. But a theory only stands up for as long as you keep your hands out of the nuts and bolts of the system, you know? Guys like you and me, we get our hands in the guts of things. Yeah, I know you're a doc as well, same as Roth. But you've kept your hands in the guts, so you'll understand. Theory only survives until you get your hands dirty and start finding all those places that the theory fails. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
I'm not quite sure, Marcus sighed.
Kevin wants this thing evaluated, Giles, for a lot of different reasons, some of which don't make a great deal of sense, at least not to me. He's worried about public opinion, legacy, ethics, all that shit. As he should be, mind you. He has to be worried about those things at his level. But between you and me, I think he believes it, man.
He stopped before a solid door and pointed at its center.
I think he believes the system we built in there is awake. Or if he doesn't believe it, he damned well wants to. In which case, I don't know what the hell to say. I don't know how to deal with someone who wants to believe a thing. Seems to me the argument's half over in that case, and a guy like me, the voice of reason, is just pushing a big rock uphill.
Without thinking, Giles said, You and he have had more than a few arguments over this, haven't you? The conciliatory look disappeared.
Look, Giles, you and I are wrench turners. Maybe you don't put your hands in hardware like I do, but that's no real difference. We both build things. Me and my team, we built that thing in there. And I'm here to tell you that at no point did we write a soul routine into the framework.
but you didn't write any routines, did you? The high-level processing, that was all trained over time, wasn't it? Most of the actual programming would have been the lower-level platform on which it rides. Marcus grunted derisively. He put his hand over the door latch, but did not open it. I have a few things to get to, Giles. I guess you'll want to head in there and have a look. Keep an eye on that belief of yours, huh? A man in your, current position. I don't imagine your career could afford any further embarrassment. Giles waited a few moments while his heart pounded. His mind had collapsed into a jumble of confusion at the shock and subsequent anger that last comment had ignited. Control and calm were the main things. He detested the lack of mental clarity he suffered in situations like this. It had been quite some time since anyone had dared to call him out so blatantly. Interviews and hearings were another animal altogether. One could prepare for those. Marcus had just perpetrated a direct attack. The suggestion read like a threat, of course, but Giles recognized the interplay beneath the words, the vying for position. How he responded would decide the outcome, and unfortunately he was rattled with anger enough that he had no rejoinder. He settled for a draw. Is there any command cheat sheet I'll need in there? What kind of interface am I dealing with? Voice? Marcus's smile widened, mouth corners drawing down to collarbones. Head on in. You'll figure it out plenty quick. Giles stepped into an antechamber large enough to house a small folding table, security guard, and a full body scanner. The guard was relaxed in a chair reading an old-fashioned book when Giles closed the door. He was standing when Giles turned around again, the book having disappeared. Dr. Guattari? Asked the guard. Giles, please. You are? He extended a hand. Brief shadow of confusion along the guard's face replaced immediately by a naked smile. He shook with Giles and gestured at the scanner. Simmons, sir. You've seen these in airports, of course. Same drill, sir. Just have your hands up and out of the way. Giles cleared his throat as he eyed the device. I opt for the pat-downs. I dislike being scrutinized. A different situation here, sir, the guard said. No human employee is reviewing the imagery. It's all automated, and the scans never saved a file. I'm the only one in here, you see. There's no one back in the cubicle. Giles craned his neck to glance behind the unit and said, Yeah, I remember when they said that about the airport scanners. We're not the airport, sir. I'll go stand out in the hall if it makes you feel more comfortable. And if I just skip the scanner altogether? Asked Giles. Well, then the door wouldn't unlock. He glanced back at the machine again and sighed. Go ahead and stay. Very well, sir. When you're ready, then. Giles stepped into the machine and raised his hands. It made no sound that he could hear, which was in itself deafening, and when the heavy click fired off to his left, he jerked back a good foot. That's the door, sir. You may step through now. Giles nodded his thanks and approached the hatch. There was no moving handle anywhere on it, only a recession under which he could hook his fingers and pull. What do you guys do if there's a fire? He asked, staring at the word Cronus stenciled above the frame. There's a panic switch on the other side of the door. Big red button. You can't miss it. It kills the power to the mag lock, and the door will just swing right open after that. Don't hit that button, okay? Sets off a building-wide alarm if you do. Understood. Giles nodded. He pulled the hatch open. The room reminded Giles of a dark cavern. It yawned like a cavern, like a gullet falling down into the hungry earth. Lights activated in sequence along the ceiling, starting at the door and flicking back row by row until he could see the other side. The space was long and deep, filled with lab benches covered in ESD maps on top of which sat clusters of monitors, a few paper notebooks, scattered pens and pencils, and the odd wrench or screwdriver. Along the right wall were shelves holding plastic bins of various size. The door shut heavily behind him, and when the locking mechanism engaged, he felt his ears pop. It took Giles a while to understand why the walls and ceiling of that room shined. He didn't notice at first that they were composed of rolled steel,
or that the seams between each panel were covered in strips of copper tape. The thing at the far end of the room had captured his attention the way nothing he had encountered in all the days of his life running up to that moment had. Not the first sight of Annalise in her wedding dress, nor the first time he had seen her clothed in nothing at all. He approached it slowly, his mouth hanging open like a forgotten cabinet. It hung from the ceiling on an articulated arm, the terminus of which anchored upward into its lower back, following a final acute joint. Hydraulics seemed to run the length of that arm. No, they weren't hydraulics. Giles saw a gearbox along one of the shafts. Worm gear, then. The top of the arm depended from a rod spanning the width of the lab, something that very much resembled a linear stage actuator. And when he looked along the room's left wall, he saw the complementary actuator for the opposing axis. The thing itself, the torso, arms, and head, floated legless over the floor. Looking closer, Giles could see that its hands had five fingers, like his, and that they appeared to be composed of an equal number of joints. The whole of it was encased in some sort of polymer shell, gray in color, which absorbed the light of the room and reflected none back, as if the light itself was being devoured by the thing's presence. A collection of thin, purple cables bundled into a mass as thick as Giles's wrist crept from the back of its head, wound up the arm from which the body hung, and was managed along the rod of the linear actuator where it disappeared through a copper-taped port in the ceiling. As Giles moved closer, he saw that its eyes were pure black, like pits of oil. "Good morning," said the lab. The voice resonated from all directions, rich and deep. "What is your name, please?" Looking around the room, searching for speakers and finding none, he stuttered, Giles? Gittery? Giles Gittery, the voice rumbled. An alliterative name. French in origin. Are you French in origin, Giles Gittery? Yes, my family hailed from Pontoise, I understand. I'm sorry, could you? Your voice is rather... Do you know? The body at the end of the room came alive, the head lifted and tracked to his position, and though the expression had not changed, could not change, it seemed to Giles, a certain intelligence was now present, where before there was none. The overhead bar began to scroll along the ceiling in his direction, bringing the truncated form toward him like hung beef pushed along a freezer track. The same voice, now small, originated from the thing itself. Is this better, Giles Gittery? Very much so, thank you. Your mouth doesn't move when you speak. He leaned slowly to one side to see it in profile, but the head moved to follow him. My mouth does not move, Giles Gittery. Would you call me Giles, please? Yes, Giles. Thank you. He took a deep breath and shook out his hands, which buzzed with pins and needles. He tried to circle around the body, but it rotated to follow him. Would you stop turning, please? The body froze. Thank you. I was hoping to get a look at your other side. You don't mind, do you?
No, Giles, I do not mind.
You should know, however, that you are not actually looking at me.
Oh, no?
He said absently. He lifted onto his toes to get a closer look at the bundle coming out of the head.
Good heavens, this is all fiber.
No, Giles, this is not me. Yes, the primary transmission medium of the sensory apparatus is fiber optic cable. Giles came back around to face it head on.
What do I call you?
The project engineers of Anagnorisis Technologies have designated me Cronus. You may refer to me as Cronus, Giles.
I see, he said.
The shock was beginning to wear off. The unsteadying vision of a body suspended from a meat hook suddenly coming alive faded until only his interest remained.
May I sit in one of these chairs?
You may sit, Giles. He wheeled over a lab chair, listening distractedly to the tinkle of its grounding chain as it skittered over the floor. He sat, noted how he had to crane his neck to look up at Cronus, and then stood briefly to squeeze the handle that would elevate the seat. It rose only an inch, so he sighed and sat back down. The machine looked down at him silently, arms limp.
There was a pause of perhaps a few seconds, followed by the slow whir of the suspension arm as Cronus rotated to face Giles and then lowered until their heads were level.
Is that better, Giles?
Yes, thank you.
He sat there, staring at the expressionless face. The body had become completely motionless, looking as though it had gone back to sleep. There was no physical mechanism within the eyes that rotated in any way that Giles could see, though he suspected they might be lenses of some sort. There were no seams in the face, no hinge or joint he could detect. He ducked slightly to look beneath the chin, at which point the head tilted back obligingly, exposing a speaker embedded in the throat under the jawline.
If this is not, you, then where are you? Asked Giles.
The structures most closely associated with me are located beneath you. These include the high-level quantum core, the intermediary layer, and the low-level silicon imperative systems.
What am I interacting with now? Giles asked.
A sensory apparatus. It is the primary means by which I interact with the physical world.
Giles looked around the lab.
You use these computers?
Doing so would be needlessly inefficient, Giles.
The computers have been placed here by the project engineers for the purposes of their own diagnostic analysis.
Jesus Christ, had that been pride he just heard?
He shook his head and breathed deeply. A few minutes in, and he was already anthropomorphizing what amounted to a multi-billion dollar science experiment. He had to watch that.
Do you know why I'm here, Cronus?
Your services have been engaged by Kevin Roth for the purposes of determining if the system designated as Cronus has attained a level of cognizance commensurate with certain rights and liberties not commonly enjoyed by less developed systems.
Giles nodded to himself and muttered, "That's one way to put it."
"What is another way to put it?" He looked back up at the machine, the sensory apparatus, and stared a long time at the frozen face. It looked like it had been chiseled from ice. He began to wonder what he was searching for. If he looked for emotion, or perhaps something just beneath emotion's foundation, unnameable and intangible. He clenched his fist, burying the nails into the palm.
That's the only way to put it, I suppose.
Cronus did not respond.
Why doesn't your mouth move when you speak?
It was a function deemed unnecessary by the engineering team responsible for building this apparatus. A mouth moves so that it may shape sound waves, process air, or consume nutrients. These functions are superfluous in my case.
Giles leaned unconsciously in his chair, looking over the visage from different angles.
Why give you a face, then?
The lack of a face is considered distracting by many.
Would you like to see? He forced his hand to relax and straightened in his chair. The thing did not move, not so much as a cock of the head.
Yes, certainly.
Mechanical hands lifted to its face. The motion was smooth, yet not as natural as the action of a human arm. Too smooth, in fact. The abundance of precision made it uncanny. Giles watched as the thumbs wedged under the ridge of the chin and flexed. There was a hollow, plastic pop, and then the entire face and scalp were lifted away from the head, exposing a geometric frame of pencil-thin aluminum spars fencing a riot of cable running in every conceivable direction. He could see that the eyes were in fact lenses of a sort, extending to long barrels anchoring at a common processor module. The head rotated to different attitudes for his benefit, and he saw how any illusion of humanity was eradicated in the understructure's exposure.
Is this sufficient? The machine asked.
Yes. Yes, I understand now. Almost insectile.
Would you like me to replace the cosmetic?
Shrugging, Giles said.
What would you prefer?
I prefer neither. The difference does not impact my function.
Giles nodded.
Replace it then.
As the face clicked back into place, Giles looked around the lab and said,
This is just a big Faraday cage, isn't it?
It is.
You've stopped addressing me by name. You continuously did so at first. Why have you stopped?
Excessive repetition of a person's name is often interpreted as an aggressive or combative posture.
You have addressed me by name. I have determined from this that it is now permissible to omit yours.
Wait, wait. You understood that this usage of a person's name is interpreted in this way, yet you did it and you stopped because I used yours?
You have used it to address me.
Giles stood from the chair and cast about the room for a notebook. He found one on the next bench over and skipped across the floor to grab it, noting as he did the whir of motors as Cronus rotated to follow him.
That is the logbook of Miss Parva Anand, the machine supplied.
Giles flipped through several pages of fine, precise notation until he found the point at which the blank leaves began. Then he upset an array of loose papers and tools on the bench until he uncovered a pen and began to scribble furiously in the book.
You will not be able to take that out of here with you.
I know, Giles muttered, writing so fast the letters were incomprehensible.
I just need to compose my thoughts. Writing them down will help me to memorize them.
Please apologize to Miss Anand for me the next time you see her.
I will see her soon. I will apologize for you when I see her.
Giles studied the notes he had scribbled for several seconds, trying to steady himself and figure out what the hell he might do next.
You are asking about the shielded nature of this room, Cronus prompted.
Giles looked up at it, mouth open, and then wrote a few more notes in the margin. He circled one of them, underlined it several times, and finally stabbed the paper with the nib.
I was, wasn't I?
I guess my first question is, why?
We've established that the, apparatus I'm addressing now is little more than a focal point, and all the parts of you that matter most are outside of this area.
You have correctly intuited that the shielding is for the purposes of security, but you have failed to understand the intent. It is not to keep the world out. It is to keep data from leaving this room.
Also, what you see before you is much more than a focal point.
You mean cell or wireless?
That is correct.
Giles glanced back at the hatch.
After all the scanning outside, how would I even get a device in here?
Multiple redundancy is a cornerstone of any reliable system.
He laughed, supposing that was so.
May I ask how you will now proceed?
Giles froze.
Yes.
Why would you ask that question, though?
I would ask a question to know the answer.
Well, yes, but why would you wish to know the answer?
The term that best fits my reason for making this inquiry is curiosity.
Jesus Christ, whispered Giles.
You are writing at a speed that defeats precision. Doing so is unnecessary.
I will wait.
Yes. No. Of course. Thank you.
No, I have to get this down.
You are agitated.
No.
Giles shook his head.
No, I don't think I'd call it that.
He put down the pen and looked up at the gray face.
If I'm being honest, I'm a little off script right now.
What does it mean to be off script?
It means I had a plan, but having soon discovered that plan to be totally pointless, I'm now making things up as I go.
Then what was your original plan?
Giles winced.
Well, I guess you'd call it a modified Turing test.
I fail to understand the applicability.
There are many less advanced systems today that pass this test easily.
The first documented instance of this test being passed was in 2014.
I know,
Giles nodded, returning to his chair.
He clicked the plunger on the pen repeatedly with his thumb.
I guess you could say I was trying to establish a performance baseline with you. Marcus and Kevin haven't really given me a great deal to work from.
The problem here is that you basically blew the test away without even trying in the first couple of minutes.
I'm not sure where to go from here.
It would seem more preparation is appropriate.
I don't know. Nobody really told me what I'd be walking into here. I have a little catching up to do.
Something caught Giles's attention, though he could not say for sure what it might be.
He thought the position of the body changed, perhaps only slightly.
Such a minimal thing if it were so,
yet such a potentially monumental signal.
How would you like to begin catching up?
Could we spend some time talking about how you're constructed?